8:06 on this Wednesday. It's August 14th. Currently 56 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Heber Valley reporting 57 degrees. Looking for a nice day. Mostly sunny skies, a high of 77. Perfect temps, right? 30% chance of an afternoon shower and thunderstorm. We've got clear skies tonight. 54 is the overnight low. Sunny and 81 for Thursday, 82 on Friday, 82 on Saturday as well. It looks like another round of some of that monsoonal moisture making its way into the area again for late Saturday on into Sunday. And the Heber Valley reporting 57 degrees, looking for mostly sunny skies, a high of 83, again with a very slight chance of an afternoon shower and thunderstorm. Clear skies tonight dropping down to a low of 47. 87 and sunny tomorrow, 88 on Friday, 88 on Saturday as well, again, as we see that monsoonal moisture moving in again late Saturday through Sunday. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City Board of Realtors President John Schumann, along with President of the Park City MLS, Bronson Calder. We'll have a look at the second quarter real estate report. Park City Manager Matt Dias will preview this week's City Council meeting, and Heber Valley Chamber Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner with a look ahead at some of the events happening there in the Heber Valley. Taking a look at some local news now, the Summit County Sheriff's Office is investigating claims of voter fraud after a few residents were accused of voting more than once in the primary. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
The Summit County Clerk's Office says it's identified five voters who cast ballots in both the Republican and Democratic primary elections. Legally, residents can only vote once. Court documents show that in each suspected case, voters were mailed ballots corresponding with their registered party, then requested the other party's ballot and cast both. In Utah, Republican primaries are closed. Democratic primaries are open, meaning anyone can request a ballot, but it's illegal for voters to cast both of them. One registered Republican who asked not to be identified by name told KPCW investigators contacted his wife last month and told her about the alleged double votes. He says he didn't know the primaries were either or.
It really wasn't voting twice. It was voting once in the Democratic primary and once in the Republican primary.
The voter says he's never voted in a Democratic primary and didn't consider it until hearing about open primaries on the news. The man says he and his wife were interested in the Democratic race for Summit County Council seat C, but they didn't know casting two ballots is a Class A misdemeanor under Utah law, which is punishable by up to a year in jail and fines. The voter KPCW spoke with says he intends to follow the law going forward. None of the five people accused of casting multiple ballots had been charged as of Tuesday, but Summit County Sheriff Sergeant Felicia Sotelo says the investigation is ongoing. The online form voters use to request a ballot from the county clerk's office does not say it's illegal to cast multiple ballots, but Summit County Chief Deputy Clerk Amy Price says the office notifies voters in numerous other ways, including over the phone.
While we have you on the phone, if ballots have gone out, we go into the system and we mark that one ineligible even before we send out a new one to you.
Voters who request a ballot over email are also told they may only vote in one primary, but clerks do allow voters to change their mind. When the office receives two ballots from the same person, Summit County Clerk Eve First says they only count the first ballot that's returned. Voting machines automate the ballot counting process. That's why clerks are confident the election results the county council ratified July 9th are correct.
Very confident. When those come in, the system flags us that this person has already voted.
More than 7,800 ballots were cast in the June 25th primary in Summit County. About 5,000 of those were Republican and 2,600 were Democratic. Overall voter turnout was 43%. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And one more reason that we keep civics classes in high school. The Park City Board of Realtors has released its second quarter stats, which show steady growth. In the studio with an analysis of the numbers, I have Board President John Schumann, along with President of the Park City MLS, Bronson Calder. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So, John, it looks like the number of sales of homes and condos did go up for those second quarter stats, as did the sales prices for the most part?
Yep. Everything continues to increase slightly. As you've seen, the number of units sold quarter over quarter was 20% higher than 2023. If we look back at what normal conditions are, we're coming back to that kind of pseudo-normal range.
So what is that pseudo-normal range? Do we have an idea of what that looks like? And that's what, pre-pandemic or even earlier than that?
Yeah, what we consider our kind of a normal market is that
time frame between 2013 and 2019. That was a pretty normal market for us, and so that's what we'd consider our normal market.
Okay. Do you want to add to that, Calder?
Yeah, sure. I mean, essentially, when looking at second quarter of 2014, we're pretty much in line. Year to date, we're about 3.5% over what we averaged during that period of time when it comes to number of transactions sold. Dollar volume's a little different thing, as we saw significant price increases over the last 3-4 years. And so dollar volume is significantly higher than it was during that normal period of time. But I think the better metric to look at here is number of transactions, and we're tracking pretty close to that period.
Were we talking about all sales when you were putting those numbers together, as opposed to breaking them out by single family and condominiums?
Yeah, that's we're looking at the overall market when we're talking about these numbers. Certainly, as you break it down into the different product categories, they're going to diverge a little bit, but laws of averages kind of all come together, and that's where the numbers are.
Okay, and then what your reports do? You look at the number of units sold, and then you also have a what you call sales volume,
mm-hmm.
And that means what? You just total up all of those sales?
That's correct. And looking at it, you know, when we finish second quarter of 2024. And we look back at the last 12 months, we're a little bit over $4 billion, which is pretty significant when you look at the actual dollar volume. When you go back to that normal period that we speak of, we were shooting just over about $1 billion. So it's a pretty significant difference.
Yeah, it sure is. Can we add four quarters up? Is that like a $16 billion industry?
No. I'm sorry, a little over $4 billion industry.
Okay, mm-hmm. That's annual.
That's the annual. That's okay. The annual from 7/1/23 to 6/30/24.
Okay. That's a lot of real estate.
It would be fun if it was $16 billion, but $4 billion for a small market like we have, I mean, that's about 2,800 units that have sold that get you to that $4 billion number. So for a small market, our dollar volume is pretty impressive.
Yeah, so when you look at the numbers, I mean, can you see any areas that did exceptionally well in terms of sales or prices?
Yeah, and the dynamics of our market have changed a little bit, where 75% of our overall dollar volume, you know, going back to the early part of that normal period, was in Park City proper and Snyderville Basin. Those numbers have definitely changed a little bit. The Heber Valley and the Jordanelle area have added significantly to our dollar volume in those statistics, and I think that trend's going to continue to change. A lot of growth in those areas, a lot of new inventory, a lot of really high-priced inventory, and so I suspect as we move into the future, that those areas are going to continue to have a pretty significant impact on our statistics.
Yeah, and then any areas that may have seen a price decrease, and that would just be really one or two sales, right? That could topple that.
Yeah, and I mean one area, you know, that we looked at the Camas Valley, their numbers are down about 25% when you look at dollar volume. When you look at number of transactions, they're also down pretty significantly. It can be little micro markets that change that. And for example, High Star Ranch, which is a more expensive, you know, kind of nicer community, or I shouldn't say nicer, but a more expensive community in Camas, over the last few years, as that was a new development and they were seeing a lot of sales, those numbers compiled. We haven't seen that new product inventory category in Camas. So what I like to tell people is, you know, because the number is down 25%, it doesn't mean your home in Camas is worth less than 25%, right? It's just how the numbers aggregate and come together. We haven't seen the higher sales over there. And so on paper, that area doesn't look good. You know, overall, pricing has stayed pretty flat in the Camas Valley.
Yeah, because I kind of walked through those. I mean, do you talk about average prices or do we talk about median prices? Which makes more sense?
You know, we look at both. Median price seems to be the better metric to look at. As when you look at averages, there are things that can skew that significantly. One large sale can dramatically affect the statistics. So most of us like to look at the median price, but the average price is also a good number to look at and understand. And so when we look at those numbers across the board, things are up slightly, but nothing like we've seen over the last 3-4 years.
And I think we need to add that when we're looking at pricing, some of our areas have such a small number of sales that we have to be very careful, and it's very nuanced, and you have to look at the bigger picture.
Yeah, still Park City seemed, and that we're talking about Park City Limits, seemed very busy with 103 single family homes being sold.
Yeah,
did I read that right?
Yep.
Yeah, and what I would say is, I don't know. I would say overall, Park City proper, the numbers are actually probably down a little bit. Certainly not when it comes to average pricing, but when you look at number of transactions and when you look at volume, those numbers are down a bit.
All right, and then I also caught my eye. The median sales prices of a single family home within the city limits nearly $4 million. That's about right there in the ballpark, huh?
That's about where it is.
Okay. Snyderville Basin median prices showed them going up 15%, prices ranging from $800,000 to $27 million. Is that the Colony there?
Well, certainly the Colony is playing into those statistics, but Promontory is the other big community where we've seen big numbers. Their average pricing has grown significantly over the last couple of years. And their volume is also monumental. It's a game changer when looking at the Snyderville Basin.
Well, so, and their median price is up to $4.6 million now.
All right, so that's really where, I mean, it used to be the higher prices were here in city limits, but it sounds like that's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
It's Promontory and Colony.
Correct.
Yeah. What does a $27 million house look like?
It's fun. They're cool. Lots of bells and whistles. You know, when you look at some of these new, what I would call a mega home, the technology that we see in them and the level of finishes is pretty exceptional. You know, full-blown internal oxygen systems that pump oxygen into the houses. Everything is automated on your iPhone. You know, it's pretty incredible what some of these new homes are capable of doing.
Basically, you don't ever need to leave.
Okay. Do you know where that house was?
So that's in the gated. There's a gated community within Promontory that's called the Pinnacle, and that home is within the gated community there. And so it's a gated community within a gated community.
Hmm. I mean, what kind of income do you need to have to buy a $27 million home?
Well, that really all depends, but the net worth is significant. I mean, you're talking several hundred million dollars of net worth when buyers are looking at that level of property.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about inventory, because I know that's something that you guys have been grappling with over the last 4 years.
Yep, and so we talked a little bit about that normal period. We're certainly reapproaching that normal period. I think we're running about 1,200 listings at the moment, which you know, during that period, I think we were 1,400 to 1,600 listings, and so we're getting back to better levels of inventory. There's more choices for buyers out there. They're seeing that and realizing that, and so it's nice to have some inventory again and have actual properties to show buyers as they're out there looking.
Yeah, I was talking earlier, we were talking about mountain bikes, about how it's really become kind of a buyer's market out there. For a year, you couldn't get a mountain bike. Now it's like everybody's got mountain bikes to sell. Is it the same in real estate?
Not quite.
Yeah, not quite. And I think we all expected the inventory to maybe grow a little bit more. The fact is that sellers are hanging tight. They've got low interest rates on their current mortgage, and that gives them some staying power. And ultimately, Park City is a great place. It doesn't seem like people are selling and leaving like we thought they might.
Yeah, what are we looking like at with interest rates? Of course, we saw that market upset with the jobs report, and then stocks went tumbling, and Then it was like, are we back into a recession, you know, and now we're talking about perhaps lowering interest rates?
I mean, I'm hearing low to mid sixes. Bronson, yeah. You hearing?
Yeah, I talked to a lender yesterday, and they had product available in the low 6% for adjustable rate mortgages, I think 30-year fixes run right about 6.5 right now, and so that's down significantly, and that no question will continue to bring buyers off the fence and back into our market. We're starting to see that. I know we had some good numbers yesterday with respect to inflation, our expectation is that as we kind of move into September, that we'll probably see some rate cuts, and hopefully those interest rates will continue to improve.
And I think it's important to note that we still have 60% of our buyers are cash in this market, so the interest rates really affect the entry level, which I'm not even sure where that is anymore, and some of our mom and pop investors, not so much the $27 million guy is not getting the mortgage.
but those markets, like, you know, certainly Heber, Camas, and many of the areas in and around Park City and Kimball Junction, Snyderville Basin, there's still a lot of product out there where people are going to need to get a mortgage, and lower rates are going to certainly continue to help improve that world.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm probably best to talk to a lender, but I mean, is there a point at which somebody may want to think about, redoing their mortgage if they were up in those upper eights, you know, when they purchased it?
That's a mortgage lender question. I mean, that's obviously a personal finance question.
But in answer to that, Leslie, I think the answer is absolutely yes. And I think that there were some buyers that accepted those high interest rates, built a lot of their closing cost into the rate with the knowledge that within a couple of years they're going to be doing a refinance and lowering that interest rate and lowering their monthly payment.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit just with the news of the 2034 Olympics coming back to Utah. For those of us who were in 2002, we certainly know what happened to real estate prices after about 2003.
We saw a big run up. We got the announcement, and then running up into, you know, the Olympics, we saw a pretty big increase in pricing, and then we did see a little bit of an Olympic hangover in real estate after the Olympics, after 2002, and we saw some numbers dip. I think a lot of that had to do with there was a tremendous amount of development, a tremendous amount of new product that was coming online at that point in time. Park City has grown. There's less development parcels. There's less new product that I think we're going to see coming on right here in Park City. So hopefully that will keep things more stable. But at the end of the day, it's a big win for us. It's going to bring a tremendous amount of national exposure. They're a marketing machine. It's going to put Park City on, you know, continue to put Park City on the map. And so as a whole, I think it's real positive for real estate pricing.
So,
and I think I'd add that in the original Olympics, the run up, Park City wasn't really on the map. And now we're on the map. And so now it's a continuing marketing push from being on the map.
All right. Because I was going to say, for anybody who does have some vacant land, I mean, this is the next 10 years, they're going to want to have it built and filled for the Olympics, yeah?
Yeah, potentially. So, what I will say with vacant land as far as the today, now, the immediate, construction prices are still very high. It's still hard to find contractors and subcontractors and things like that. That, when you look at actual number of transactions in the land world, they're down. So I think people are at the moment looking at existing product more than they're looking at land. I do suspect that over time that, you know, the land category will come back into play. We're also seeing some less pressure on that construction world, and I suspect over the next couple of years we'll start to see some of those numbers come back down, and people re-entering into the let's go ahead and build a home on our existing piece of land.
Okay. Any other observations?
It's not a real exciting report. You know, the numbers are good. They're better than last year. They're not great. We still have some more work to do. But I would say, certainly better, and the outlook is pretty good. I think one other observation that I would just quickly mention is seasonality is back in our market, where things used to just be go, go, go 12 months a year. We're starting to see that seasonality come back into our market. And so, and we certainly recognize that in the second quarter of this year, which was slow. You know, when we went into our quote unquote mud season, the numbers reflect that. We didn't have as many buyers out there. We had an exceptional late July, and so far in August is wonderful when we're looking at number of pended properties. And so seasonality is back. You know, we'll typically see kind of that March and April is big months, July, August, September, good months. And the worst 2 months that we always see are November and December. And you know, I think that's primarily due to people are into the holidays and spending time with family and doing that. And so so seasonality is certainly back into our world.
All right. And I guess what I'm kind of hearing from realtors is that they're doing a lot of fishing and not a lot of catching. Is that your...
There's a lot of fishing out there. And but I would also add that I think our growth has come to a more sustainable point where we're not at the pandemic levels where we were seeing properties appreciate 40%. We're back into that 3 to 5 to 7 range where... It's sustainable, and it will continue that way, I think.
I agree with that.
Okay. Bronson, John, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
The Park City Board of Education will vote on whether to renew Superintendent Jill Gilday's contract at its meeting next week. KPCW's Christine Weller reports that it will also be proposing a tax increase.
The Park City School District Board's next meeting is Tuesday, August 20th. On the agenda is a board vote on whether to renew Superintendent Jill Gilday's contract. The handling of Gilday's contract has been a point of contention between board members in recent months. Board President Andrew Kaplan told KPCW in June the board was planning to extend Gilday's contract this year. This prompted parents in the district to circulate a change.org petition requesting Gilday's contract not be considered for renewal until voters elect new board members in November and they take office in January. The board has also been divided on renewing the contract, in part because of the superintendent performance review process. Reed and fellow board member Nick Hill said they have not been involved in any state-required review of Gilday's performance since joining the board in 2023. Hill said he has not seen any historical performance review information either. The board is also proposing a property tax increase and will have a truth in taxation hearing after the 4 p.m. meeting. If the proposal is approved, the district tax on a $1.1 million residence would be over $2,000, an increase of over $133 per year. The district tax on a $1.1 million business would be almost $4,000, or a nearly $250 per year increase. The public is invited to give input at the 6 p.m. hearing. Both meetings are at the Park City School District building on Kearns Boulevard. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council meets in work session Thursday starting at 4:40 with a water impact fee update. And in the studio with details, Park City City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. So that water impact fee discussion, first item on the work session agenda, the report long and cumbersome. Bottom line, it looks like that impact fees could go up substantially. I mean, we're talking like 10 grand.
Could. I think that is the potential. It's been almost 10 to 15 years since I think we've updated this study, and one of our lessons is that it's better to probably eat this elephant in bites in sort of a 3 to 5 year period as opposed to waiting 10 to 15 years to make these types of updates. However, you know, the mayor and council have been very sensitive thus far about increasing water fees and impact fees. And so they were incredibly deliberate in terms of reducing the potential water rate increase this past year during the budget process. And this is just the beginning of this conversation. I think this is going to be, again, probably a conversation that will occur over several meetings where the mayor and council are trying to put some downward pressure on these increases. However, we have new development. We have growth or change in uses. Those uses typically are supposed to pay their own way. They're supposed to pay into the system so the existing water rate payers at our commercial level or residential level aren't paying for new growth or new development and new connections. Clearly, there's a sweet spot in here. I think this is the beginning of a longer conversation. No one wants to increase water rates less than us, but unfortunately, it does. You know, it's an enterprise fund, it's a public utilities fund, and we have to be stewards of the system.
Right, and we have about $170 million in bonds or something to pay for all of the waterworks that we've done with, you know, from Judge Tunnel to, you know, the new Three Kings treatment plant, huh?
Well, and as you recall, rolling it back a little, we were incredibly fortunate. We actually, we were supposed to bond in three phases for the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant. And because of the favorable interest rates and what was occurring in the financial markets, we actually consolidated two of the issuances into one issuance. And I recall we saved the taxpayers and the district almost $5 to $7 million that would have otherwise been paid. So, you know, we have been very conservative thus far. We did just roll on board a new project, but financially we've been pretty savvy, and we hope that's been a benefit to the ratepayers. That said, Park City, very, very complicated water system, an incredible amount of regulation, and we get the majority of our water from our mines, and we want to make sure that it's treated adequately and we protect public health, safety, and welfare.
So what about for all of the affordable housing that's going to be built or is being built? We're talking about Engine House, HOPA, Studio Crossing, perhaps whatever's on the 5 acres. Will they then be given waivers for these impact fees?
They may, and I think that's a fair question. I think a lot of communities, particularly in the mountain resort communities that have relatively high water costs, such as ourselves, are dealing with this factor about we are trying to incentivize and make it easier to develop affordable housing. And one of the means of doing that is waiving some of the development and permit fees to make it more affordable for the private sector to bring that type of housing product to bear. And so, again, there's a sweet spot in here. There's a balance. And I think every time the mayor and council obtain one of these fee waiver requests, they're sort of calculating and weighing the pros and cons of achieving that new housing product. We have a housing crisis in our community, vis-a-vis how much of that they're willing to spread throughout the ratepayers in the community. So there is a deliberate conversation there every time they review one of these requests.
All right, because there is a fee waiver for Studio Crossing later on in the agenda for more than $1.6 million. I'm just curious whether or not that includes a waiver for the impact fees.
It may. I believe the request was actually $2.5 million. And I believe the recommendation is to consider only $1.5 million of that request for the what our team is calling the eligible or the ineligible housing requirement. So the developer has a housing requirement out there. We are not advocating that be considered. And then they're also providing housing over and above what is required, and that's what they're asking for these development and permit fees. But again, it's a difficult conversation. Every time we make these fee waivers, we're spreading those costs throughout the system. The mayor and council have tried to put a lot of downward pressure on cost increases and rate increases. This last year, for example, at one point we were contemplating a 10% rate increase, and I think we brought it down to about 4 or 5.
All right. Council will also be recapping the June 27th work session on that Bonanza 5-acre property. If the council agrees to go over this 10,000 square foot cap of retail in the area, it sounds like that may not then meet the city's affordable MPD process. And that means what?
Well, I think that question is probably maybe a little bit too far into the weeds. We are contemplating obtaining a master developer for this site. And so getting ahead of ourselves to know what type of development applications or MPDs would be submitted and otherwise, there are multiple ways to develop this property. And this might require different buildings or connected buildings. This may require a replatting exercise. So to make that type of a general statement kind of here on the radio, I wouldn't want to mislead people. However, the mayor and council did affirmatively seek more retail in general, kind of ground level, vibrant local retail than was initially contemplated by the consultants. And I believe that's what you're alluding to.
Well, I'm just saying it's the affordable master plan development zone that then allows them less parking, higher buildings, and less setbacks.
Correct.
But then you've got to meet the standards of that affordable MPD.
Yeah, if you are submitting an application under the affordable MPD.
Sure.
And so that's a choice on behalf of any property owner. It would be the choice of the municipality or a private property owner. We also have the master plan development process, which doesn't necessarily have those constraints. Allows you arguably to be a little bit more flexible overall. Now, you may have to ask for some gives and takes or some puts and takes. But again, we're getting way ahead of ourselves in terms of we are at a conceptual stage. We made a considerable amount of progress putting out a request for statement of qualifications. We are currently working on a request for proposals that we potentially will hope to have out by maybe even the end of the summer or early fall. So making a tremendous amount of progress there and really proud of the work that we've done.
Okay. Has anybody kind of ballparked what it costs to build underground parking today?
Well, it really runs the gamut, and I think it depends on who you speak with and who you talk to. Conventional wisdom is it's definitely over $30,000 or $35,000 per space. I've heard estimates as high as $60,000. Mm-hmm. So clearly there's some type of a range in there. But that range is fundamentally dependent upon the soil, the topography, the groundwater. There's numerous factors which will determine the ultimate cost, and also the economy of scale you can create. It's one thing to create one parking deck. It's another thing to create multiple parking decks, how far you have to excavate, the cost of concrete. So there's numerous factors in there, and I would be just taking a swat on the wall.
Yeah, and have any numbers been computed for what may happen here? I mean, how much the city, I guess, would be on the line for? I guess, at what point do we see how this new process compares with the first go-around?
I think soon, and in my heart of hearts, I think pretty soon here. I think we're turning a big corner. There's another item on the agenda to potentially underground some of the transmission lines that currently run right down the middle of the five-acre property that the municipality owns, which is a huge step in site preparation and opening or reopening the development potential of this parcel, maximizing the value of that land, hardening for wildfire. So we are moving deliberately, and I think we're turning a big corner. Currently, the mayor and council have allocated the transient room tax proceeds 100% to the district. That's our existing direction. We don't have direction to be pulling in additional resources at this point. But again, getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, and we put out a request for proposal. We will be seeking qualified firms to come up with creative strategies, financial, transportation, housing, you know, the ground level retail conversation we just had, pedestrian pathways, and more, and seeking a favorable developer to bring a creative strategy to us.
So the underground, putting those power lines underground, it's like a $7 million due. Who pays for that? City?
I don't know. I think right now it's probably fundamentally 100% the city. We believe that's in the best interest of the redevelopment part aspects of the parcel. We've been trying to, you know, I was having a conversation with some of the individuals in the organization the other day, and this conversation about the substation and the power lines, we've been having these conversations for almost 20 years. I even got a text message from an old employee who's long time moved on and said, Matt, I can't believe you guys are here at this milestone. This is incredible. But right now, we are making that investment because we believe it unlocks the potential of that land. There are some abutting property owners that we also think have an interest and will benefit. So we're coming up Thursday evening with some creative financial strategies. There's some resources we can draw upon. If folks are interested, the staff report really has a one-time anomaly with some interest accruals that we've accrued as a result of being at the precipice of several other capital projects, overhauling the Mark Aquatics facility, the city park building. So we've been holding some balances, and we've benefited from the interest accrued on those. So we might have a one-time opportunity to close the gap here.
Okay. And I guess, I mean, I just question, it's like, how does putting transmission lines underground meet city goals?
Well, I mean, but for that, we would have bought this 5-acre parcel that is really inhibited from being redeveloped. There's at least a 30-foot buffer on either side of these transmission lines that would inhibit any vertical development and a lot of surface level development. So by undergrounding these power lines, there is a considerable community benefit to helping us achieve our goals. By way of an example, 7 years ago when we bought this parcel, it was sort of always contemplated that this would be an expenditure. So to reach this milestone that is really a tipping off moment where we can achieve some of the community redevelopment goals that would otherwise be unavailable to us if we left these power lines in place.
Okay. Let's see. The council will also get an update on the last meeting of this new Main Street Area Plan Committee. Can you just back up a bit and tell us why this committee was formed and exactly what has it been tasked to do?
Yeah, I think fundamentally it was a council priority to consider the future reinvestments, city assets, and the vibrancy of sort of the Main Street area in general. We sort of rolled things back to some of the studies that were done in the 80s and the 90s and even early 2000s that really set the street up for 15 to 20 years of success with plazas and widened sidewalks and new infrastructure. And I think after years of working with the business district and hearing their request for additional investment, we said, is there a way we can fast forward a planning process, work with the business district, retain our competitive advantage to some of the growth that's happening around us, look into some unique transportation initiatives, and a reinvestment strategy? To be honest, to forward Main Street for the next 10 to 20 years in this community. It'd probably been about 15 years since we'd done that type of an exercise. So the mayor and council liaison Ryan Dickey convened a committee of Main Street business owners and some residents. We procured some consultants to help us with statistical and analytical and transportation exercises. And the work that they're coming up with is a little controversial. It's a little bold. We believe that's representative of what the committee wants and the Main Street merchants. But we won't know till they sort of identify some of these concepts. I believe they've had two or three meetings. And these are half-day meetings. So these business owners are really taking their time and their energy and their intention, and they're dedicating it to the future of Main Street. So really exciting things coming out of here. In fact, we have another meeting today occurring at City Hall. I believe it's another half-day meeting. And then this September, with some design concept, we'll be unveiling to the public to obtain public feedback, public information, and see how people respond and react to them. So exciting times. And this is something that's happened episodically at the municipality with the merchants sort of every 10 to 15 years.
Are these meetings open to the public?
I believe so. I'd have to check, though, off the top of my head. I'm not sure.
Well, one of the proposals is this town square proposal located right here where the Main Street post office is. I mean, the post office used to be our town squares. It was either there or at the Alpha Beta where everyone knew everyone. In the past, the post office has wanted to get off Main Street, but city officials was like, how can you have a Main Street without a post office? So what's the thinking now? Is it changing?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't there then. That's the first time I've heard that it was city officials. I had always heard that it was a community sentiment. And so the community, the elected officials or the city officials were representing community sentiment at that time. It felt like the post office was a grounding element of Main Street, and knowing thy neighbor and seeing people and having community and conversation. That's what I was always led to believe, and that we were personifying what they were hearing for the public. However, I think it's a really interesting idea. What I read in that report was it could be another representation of partnerships. There could be a partnership with the merchants, with the municipality, and with the post office. That is a relatively old building, but some of the facade is historic and otherwise, where there could be some really dynamic way of creating some public-private partnership, working with the business owners and the United States Post Office, where we could make this a more vibrant area, a community gathering place, a civic plaza or otherwise, but still retain some of the fundamental elements of a grounded community where you see your neighbor, you know your neighbor, and you know the postal patrons, and there could be some other activities in there. And again, this is a concept, so I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. We are a ways off. But it seems really dynamic and fun and interesting and creative.
Have you heard from the post office about potentially wanting to decommission the Main Street location?
I have not directly. No. But like you, I've been in this community long enough where I've heard little starts and stops and whispers of this, that, and the other. I haven't heard anything in years. Again, it's sort of just a design concept that came out of a collaborative and creative process. It seems really interesting.
Okay, and just real quick, because I've got another interview waiting, but the shuttle bus leasing, and I guess why would the city consider a lease of a bus over a bus purchase? And it sounds like, based on what I read in the staff report, is that the buses that were purchased earlier, just you're having a lot of problems with them.
There's a couple things going on here. You said you just want to rush, so I don't want to take too much of your time. Two things are occurring. We are waiting for a large delivery of Gillig electric buses. Before those buses arrive, we want to make sure we have an adequate level of fleet to support special events, winter tourism, and otherwise. That's fundamentally one reason why we are seeking this temporary leasing, making sure going into this winter, depending on when this fleet arrives, that there is no lapse in service as a result of us not being prepared or awaiting a delivery. Your second question about the existing fleet of some of our electric buses that were purchased maybe 7-8 years ago, it's hard for me to recall. Those have had some maintenance issues. They've been considerable. If you recall, we were sort of at the bleeding edge. There was one moment there where Park City was Park City was on the face of every public transit magazine in the country. We were being invited to conferences around the world, around North America, for being one of the first investors in an electronic fleet of buses and how they could operate in a winter climate at grade with a lot of different types of topography. But that was bleeding edge infrastructure, and so we are replacing that now.
Okay. Matt, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
That's Park City City Manager Matt Dias. On the phone now with an update from the Heber Valley, Jessica Turner, the Public Relations Manager for the Heber Valley Chamber. Good morning, Jessica.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Hard to believe. Feels like summer's over because the Heber Market on Main is ending. Tell us.
It is. Yeah, this is the last week for it. So it'll actually be tomorrow night. And we will have a booth set up there providing some information about some things that are happening throughout the community that will go more in depth than even we can touch on today. So if anyone's around and available, come on over to the Heber City Park for that Market on Main.
Okay. And that starts, what, at 5?
5 to 9. Yeah, live music starts a little bit after 5 o'clock. The vendors and food trucks and artisan booths will all be set up a little bit before 5. It's kind of it's a great community vibe and feel for the culture in the area. You bring some chairs, you bring some blankets, you have some dinner, maybe throw some bean bags and enjoy some cornhole and just sit around and meet new people. It's a really fun experience if you haven't done it before.
Okay, and then maybe go through some of those others that are coming up here in August, the events.
Yeah, I'll just highlight some of the more unique events that are coming up. So the Park City Sailing Group will be holding their junior regatta at Jordanelle. That's this weekend. Friday, Saturday. We've got a U2 tribute concert. So the Ideal Playhouse, which was formerly the Ideal Theater here along Heber City Main Street, was recently purchased and completely overhauled. The interior is completely redone. It's a fantastic new live event venue, and they're bringing in some concerts, some performances, some plays and theater, things of that nature that are traveling performances. And so up next will be the U2 concert. They'll have two show times, both on August 16th. So if you haven't been, it's definitely worth a visit. We also have a hike-in yurt dinner. So the Nordic yurt that typically does the winter snowshoe 5-course dinner in the winter season converts to summer activities, and that includes these seasonal yurt hike-in dinners. And their next one will be August 17th, and then their final one of the season will be the 31st. And that's over at Soldier Hollow on the southwest portion of Midway and Wasatch Mountain State Park.
How long of a hike is that, do you know?
Oh, it's about a half mile. It's really not bad, and it's fairly flat. You kind of traverse along the hillside there, and it's guided, mostly so that the guide can provide some historical and Olympic information along the way to and from and answer any questions that visitors may have about the area. So it's a really nice, slow-paced experience.
Okay, and anything else you wanted to mention?
Yeah, we'll talk about, there's a Boomerfest Music Festival. It's an annual event that happens at the Erickson Foundation out in Wallsburg. That is happening at the end of the month. So if you really want to go out with a bang for the summer season, that'll be August 23rd through the 25th. And then, of course, Swiss Days. Every Labor Day weekend, Friday and Saturday, we anticipate tens of thousands of people, including a lot of moms, a lot of strollers, and a lot of vehicles coming to that Midway Town Square area. My recommendation is either get there early for the best pickings on Friday morning at 8 a.m., or if you're less worried about being the first, Friday around 2 or 3 o'clock, it starts to slow down a little bit, takes a little bit of a lull, and it's a great time to visit the Swiss Days booths.
Okay.
And new this year, they're having a dog march as a part of that event on that Saturday. It does need to be in a purebred or as purebred as it can be Swiss canine, and you can enter those in on the website over there at the Swiss Days website as well.
And is this when the Volksmarch also happens during Swiss Days?
You know, Volksmarch actually happens mid-September. Mm. So it's coming up, and they took a break last year, so it is returning this year, and we're really thrilled to hear that. So Volksmarch will also be happening mid-September on that Saturday.
Okay. Let's see. You also have some results from your Shop Local sentiment survey that you conducted this spring. Tell us about that.
Yep. So we conducted a survey over the course of about 7-8 weeks, about 2 months, that we presented and pushed out via email and social media with some advertising as well here locally throughout the Wasatch County, trying to get a deeper understanding of what locals are purchasing here, what residents are purchasing here locally, what they're not, and the reasons for it. We got some really interesting insights. I won't go too in depth, but I'll just say that it was great to be able to gather that kind of first level data. I would say of note, and some of this isn't going to be too surprising, but things like sporting goods, specialty gifts and things that you can often get off Amazon, of course, were preferred for either out of market or online shopping, whereas things like groceries, auto parts and auto accessories and things more, and those industries were purchased here locally. So this is all part of a larger initiative for us to continue our efforts in supporting these local boutique shops and local retail stores. And it's one important layer of information as we embark on a Shop Local and Love Local campaign that we'll be introducing in the fall. In addition to that, we've also revamped some of our website and some of our strategy for marketing efforts here locally to garner more support and have a louder voice for encouraging our residents to spend the dollars local and get to know these local businesses, because it's not just about sales tax revenue generation. It's also about knowing your neighbors and supporting the people that need to also live and thrive in our community.
Yeah, now did the survey delve into kind of traffic hassles at all, or was it really just about shopping?
It was specifically about shopping. However, some of the questions did offer pre-selected or pre-built in answers about traffic congestion and some of the other reasons why people might prefer to either shop online or just bundle their shopping experience if they're heading into the Provo, Orem, or Salt Lake areas, or even into Park City, you know, with the boutiques shops there and the outlet mall there. So it did touch on that. We can definitely gather some insights from some of the responses and some of the free fill forms that traffic congestion is a deterrent in certain parts of our valley, and that's definitely something that we are looking to mitigate as best we can.
All right. Is there a place where people can go and get those full survey results at this point?
No, those have not been shared publicly, just through some of our board meetings and some of our Donuts with the Director events and things like that, where we're sharing some highlights. As we continue to gather some additional information and get some feedback from our board, something we can definitely look to make more public. But as of now, if they want to give us a call, we're happy to share some of those insights in greater detail.
Okay. And then before I let you leave, any idea, and we can talk about this with Dallin kind of next month, but what kind of summer you've had in the Heber Valley? I think here in Park City, we've seen the numbers down, but still the daily room rate for hotels up.
Sure, yeah. So it's been an interesting summer. It feels, living here locally and working here locally, it has felt busier than any prior summer. All of our events are hitting record numbers, which is fantastic. Our state parks are still seeing really high visitation numbers overall. It's been interesting with some of the lodging, tracking ADR, tracking occupancy rates. It's a little bit of that teeter-totter, you know, do you play with the ADR or do you lower it, and how does that impact travel decisions coming into our market? Overall, though, we've been trending up, which I know that the state has been down or even flatlined in some cases when you look at restaurant tax and average daily room rate and TRT, transient room tax. We've had a pretty good performance of our year to date from January through some numbers we only have through May, and others through June and some through July. But that being said, we're tracking ahead of some of the previous years. You know, you take into consideration COVID and that anomaly of that year, and you take that out of the equation, certainly. But when we look at 2023 and 2022 data, in some instances, we're tracking ahead, and in other months, we're slightly behind or just right on par with. And overall, I'd say the performance numbers are looking good and strong. Certainly, we would like to see a little bit more visitation to some of our restaurants and some higher occupancy rates, but it's nothing that we're overly concerned about as of now.
Okay. Jessica, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Jessica Turner, again, is the Public Relations Manager for Heber Valley Chamber.